So I'd like to explore a question that is at the heart of a lot of practice, which is essentially, if I am inherently good, radiant, and wise, why do I not act like it much of the time? And why do I have to work so hard to become who I have always already been? Classic question, of course. And it goes to some teachings that are present in early Buddhism, as best we can gather from them early, from the surviving written records there in the so-called Pali Canon. There are some references to the Buddha saying, or someone pretending to be the Buddha in the written record saying, I think of it all as kind of like the Buddha stream. So in the Buddha stream, there's some words along the lines of essentially, the nature of mind is inherently pure. The nature of consciousness is inherently pure. And then the other 99% of the words in the Pali Canon are about dealing with all the impurities, you know, in the mind. And it reminds me a little bit of the metaphor that I heard a while back, which goes like this. If you, let's say, acquire a home that's been boarded up for many decades, maybe it's a house in the woods you're now going to have for yourself, and you go into it and, you know, the faucet has been turned off for 30 years and you turn it on so the water can flow, and out comes initially a bunch of green, brown, smelly stuff. And the tendency is to turn it off. But what you need to do is to let that water flow, which is, you could say, a metaphor for mindfulness, for awareness, for being with what's there. We let our experiences flow. And then as they gradually flow and release and all the rest of that, some of the weightier content, you know, and even the subtler flotsam and jetsam gradually disperses on its way. Beautiful, beautiful. And a second teaching in that metaphor is that the nature of the water itself, every molecule of H2O, the nature of water itself is always inherently pure water, containing all kinds of other content. But the water itself, the ground of being itself, the field of awareness itself, is inherently pure. And okay, so that's pretty beautiful. Then the notion of underlying Buddha nature, bodhicitta, etc., gets more developed in the Buddhist traditions in Tibetan, Zen, and then onward Pure Land Buddhism. So I want to explore with you a little bit about that as it applies to our lives today, and how it could actually help us, how it does actually help us to tune into and access our sense of innate goodness, even while dealing with our struggles, and including our struggles with other people, and our struggles in the political environments in which we're dealing today. So I want to start here a little bit with Roy Cohen's comment. Roy writes, although at times I feel warm-hearted from inside, when I look at myself from the outside, I look to myself as harsh and closed up. I often struggle to see my own goodness because of that. So let's suppose that a person is actually harsh and closed up some of the time. Okay. Why? What purpose or function does that serve? What is the intention, including unconsciously represented in the body mind, in the brain especially? What is the intention? Well, the intentions are always good at bottom. You know, we're harsh because we are, you know, have good intent. We're trying to protect ourselves, or we're quick, or that's how we grew up. It's such as how we learn to be. Maybe that's our temperament. Maybe we're just a kind of more of a fiery, blunt, matter-of-fact kind of person. Just so the intent there is to simply continue living and going on being and being who we are. Or let's suppose closed. What's closedness in the service of? Potentially protecting oneself, not, you know, wanting to let leak out onto others some of the stuff that's still swirling around inside. okay, it's good intent. Every single, it's kind of wild, and I want to really offer this to you. I was listening to Mingyur Rinpoche recently in an interview that Forrest and I had with him for our podcast, and he made a comment that really struck me about how even our neurotic stuff that I as a therapist will, you know, pay attention to in my own mind and out there in other people, even that neurotic stuff is well-intended. It too is an expression of our innate goodness. Wow. In other words, even all the crud and garbage and myself that I've been trying to get rid of, even all of that is an expression of my inherent goodness, my inherent goodness of heart, goodness of intent. Wow. Wow. So I want to invite you, Roy included, into reflecting on that in your own case. It doesn't mean to get sloppy or, you know, just indifferent about the wreckage you leave around you with your communications. It just is a way to see truly, see clearly. And then when you see into the good intent behind quote unquote bad behavior deep down, then when you rest in that good intent, you can find better ways to enact it that are more flexible, more attuned to the present, less relics of training from your childhood. Okay, so far? Really important. And then I want to draw your attention to a visual aid here. And I've presented this visual aid previously, and I'm going to focus on a particular aspect of it. So here we go. I consider this to be the truth of things. In a broad sense, imagine that each layer of this triangle is actually 10 or 1,000 times bigger than the layer above it. And so out in the world, we see actual harms being done occasionally by ourselves, often by others, often at vast and unfortunate scales by large, powerful forces such as militaries and certain governments and certain leaders and policies and structural poverty and inequity and injustice. Actual harms, no denial of actual harms. The planet is getting hotter. Actual harms. Then there is also what is not directly objectively harmful yet, but is poisoning our culture. Toxic spectacle. Scads of disinformation and misinformation and trolls and bad actors, social freeloaders and social media and all the rest of that. It's all true. Okay. So you have the first two layers. Could be just summarized in two words. What sucks? It's real. That's what's out there in the world. And then there's the rest of it. Okay. And we have certainly right now 10, 20, 100 million people and organizations, probably more actually, around the world, ranging from somebody, you know, picking up somebody else's litter in the street, to some people fixing a pothole, to people working in healthcare settings, school teachers, all kinds of nonprofit organizations, scientists, public policy groups, advocacy groups, all around the world, including in pretty harsh conditions. I'm sure in North Korea, there are some people coming together there in the context of that dictatorship to make things better, you know, out of service to the people around them. Great. Many of whom are you included, I'll bet you, in the ways that you make donations, you offer your time and service, maybe you're part of a nonprofit organization of one kind or another, you too are helping to make a better world. Perhaps you donate to political campaigns, just vote, or, you know, share what you know is factually true. What a concept, factually true, with other people. You're helping to make a better world. Notice that. And then we have the goodness in ordinary lives. And I really want to focus on this one here with you. The goodness in ordinary lives, people in enjoying a cup of coffee, you know, a glass of water, making a meal, laughing, making love, having children, raising their children, just enjoying life, you know, planting a tree, repairing a faucet, just goodness. And here I want to draw your attention to your own generosity, your own generosity. It's said that as the Buddha traveled from here to there throughout northern India during his 40-year, roughly, teaching career after his awakening, it is said that the first thing he typically taught was the value of generosity, not toxic altruism, pathological altruism, but the givingness of a warm heart, the generosity of attention, sustaining, giving your attention to somebody else, the generosity, certainly supporting the monastics and supporting others of their time with a little food here, a little help there, the generosity of letting another person go ahead of you, just the ordinary generosity of everyday life, doing some dishes for somebody else, you know, gifts, your own givingness. Lovingness is givingness. You know, there's a generosity to it. The giving of forgiving. You know, we started out early before we actually got formally started with how to respond to a complaint about you, oh my goodness, from somebody else, and the generosity of receiving the complaint. I did a interview with Forrest earlier today about extricating oneself from problematic relationships, and we were talking about one of the indicators of a problematic relationship is to be with someone whose complaint department is never open. You know, like the sign, complaint department, out to lunch. They're always out to lunch. They're never there to receive your complaint. And that's kind of a giveaway. That's not good. Well, flip it around. You have the generosity of being open to, maybe grudgingly at first, but then you settle down, the receiving the complaints of others. So I want to, and I invite you to take a moment to kind of rest and reflect on, you know, the many, many good intentions you have. Good intentions to get your job done, to do your duty, right? Yeah, good intentions to, you know, put the cap back on the toothpaste tube, to pick up your own socks, you know, to stop at stop signs and look both ways before continuing, you know, to honor your agreements, good intentions to keep your word, you know, and then just think about all the, you know, efforts you've made. Often while being tired or stressed or strained, you know, to just do your best again and again and again and again. I know quite a few of you from past experiences, workshops, different settings, communications. And I think, you know, honestly, a lot of you don't really give yourself enough credit for your own good intentions, your own generosity, and your own goodness. It's interesting that in divisive times, with a fair amount of pathologizing of other people across the aisle and so forth, it's quite a refuge to rest in your own good intent. And, you know, the knowing of your good efforts, which includes your willingness to repair and to receive the complaints of others. That's a real refuge. And now I'd like to kind of build on this in a particular way. And I'm asking for your generosity of attention here to what I'm about to bring up. And you'll understand why I said that in a moment. So, as you may know, one of my own forms of generosity over the last over 3 years now has been a nonprofit I started called the Global Compassion Coalition. And basically, I've given the majority of my working hours to this nonprofit as a volunteer for over 3 years. I've really put myself into it. And it's actually grown remarkably. If you go to our website, you'll see that the fundamental aim here is to use the power of compassion to galvanize the collective action that the world needs for systemic change. The world already has a lot of focus on individual consciousness. The world already has a lot of efforts in their own silos to make a better world. And meanwhile, the forces of wealth and power are dragging us toward catastrophe. We need to come together at larger and larger scales to be big enough, to be strong enough, to promote the common good, the good of the many, not just the few. That's the fundamental purpose of the Global Compassion Coalition, responding to the suffering, especially the needless suffering due to systemic forces of injustice of others. It's an ambitious and noble vision. We've gone for it, and it's galvanized the interest of 150,000 people so far and growing rapidly, and with a core of 1,000 really distinguished people among our founding supporters and founding organizations. You're very welcome to join the coalition. It's free. Everything about it is freely offered. We have the occasional paid program, some of them created by me. If financial issues are significant, you can do everything we offer for free, fundamentally. So that's the Global Compassion Coalition. And at this time of year, when people start thinking about donations to nonprofits, tax-deductible donations to nonprofits, I would really request that you consider your own gratitude to me, you know, your own appreciation of my generosity to you in these sitting groups and other things I do. And if you're so moved, you know, donate to the Global Compassion Coalition. You can donate in my name, $1 or, wow, $1 million would be great. I'm not expecting it. So that's my request to you. So I want to keep going here with a question that got asked to me. And I think it was shared publicly, so I'm going to use her name. Ann Wiener, she said essentially, when I was talking about not letting the poison of hatred invade our heart, and particularly in these political times, she was basically saying, well, anger energizes me. Anger mobilizes me. And there's a truth to that. And I think it's really important to not suppress anger and also to appreciate its uses, but don't let it use you. The uses of anger are to highlight what matters most and to mobilize energy toward it. Great. On the other hand, if anger carries us away, it gradually wears us down, so we have less and less capacity to fight the good fight, and it can create a lot of interpersonal consequences with other people. And this really comes back to, for you, multiple motivations that lead in the same direction. For example, it may be that when you look out at the world, you're furious at certain things about it. I know I am. I'm furious. I remember traveling to Haiti and walking around there for the 2 days, essentially, I was there in a cold rage. I was very, very controlled about it. It was appropriate. I was appalled at the life for most of the people there. There's a place for that. There's a place for that. And alongside that cold rage was a lot of compassion and a lot of respect and an analytical and constructive focus on my mind around how can I make an actual difference here? How could I actually help? So right there, we would have multiple horses, multiple motivations going down the same road. Cold rage, compassion, constructive desire to help. Grief and what people were dealing with there. All of it going down the same road. The question then becomes, which one are you primarily riding? The rage, the anger is there. It's going down the road. But if that's the horse you're mainly riding in how you act in the world, as the Buddha said famously a long time ago, see for yourself. See for yourself what actually are the results of riding that particular motivational horse of intention. You decide. And you might find that what works best is kind of blends. You know, that cold rage in the background, as they say in Zen, you know, firm back, soft front, stiffens your backbone. you know, your sense of moral clarity and outrage back here, while in the front of you, you're more measured, you're gentler, you bring the gravitas, the weight of people like, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. or, you know, I'm a fan of Michelle Obama and others, you know, you bring that moral weight. And Pema Chodron, for example, you bring that moral weight. So I invite you to think about in your own life, what are for you some of the multiple intentions that you have for dealing with things, you know, including with your partner. So speaking of myself, my long-suffering wife, Jan, she'll do a thing where I'm with a fair amount of momentum because I'm dealing with a fairly long to-do list every day. It's getting shorter, but it's still long. I'm moving from one room to another. I'm getting something done. I'm moving through it. And I'm on my way into the other room to do the thing, you know, like to put something in the recycling. And she'll say, with good intent, yeah, please put that in the recycling. Now I'm going toward the recycling. I'm putting it in the recycling. What do I do then? I grew up with controlling, advice-giving parents. I have some relics of that reactivity still within me. So anyway, what do I do? One motive, one of my ponies, one of my horses, is to, you know, be kind of irritable with her, snarky, say something. And then I have another horse alongside that one that has more noble intent, you know, more noble intent to take into account the larger picture. I play an internal game about how fast can I get off my positions? How fast can I release authentically a reaction authentically? And, you know, it's a fun game to play with yourself. It's a game that, you know, only you keep score internally. And it's a game you can win at because you can get faster and faster at it. What a good game. How quickly can I genuinely release around some position? The cortisol may still be not yet metabolically fully metabolized or released, but on the whole, it's not invading you. It's not remaining in your mind. You're like increasingly free of it. How fast can you do that? Depending on how big things are. Obviously, it's slower with bigger things. So in any case, I've got those two ponies riding side by side. Which one do I act from? And it just goes better if I, you know, act from the wise pony rather than the reactive pony. So I wonder what you think about this in terms of your own intentions. And can you recognize, you know, the depth of good intent that's actually in you? That's actually in you. As Elaine puts it here, which pony, which wolf, which pony do you feed? So I want to see if there are questions about this particularly, including related to the fact that if you think about both of them, both the horses have good intentions underneath it all. And one of them probably has more generosity of heart, more generosity of spirit. Well, I'm going to do something I haven't done in a while. I'm going to take an actual real question from my friend Madison. Okay. Short and sweet. Oh, my goodness. As you know, Madison, I always say it to everybody. If you could, if I'm going to talk with you, please have a succinct, clear question of general interest related to the topic at hand. All right, this cut to the chase.
Spectacular. Okay, here's the chase real life experience from today. I'm managing 4 or 5 people, cleaning up household situations, and I see something I don't like or want to change, or someone's doing it not the way I want it, and I go smashing in and with a comment. Sometimes it's comment like, good job, but that's not the one I'm bringing up to you. The one I'm bringing up to you is, no, don't do that, or I'm allergic to that, or stop that, or what are you doing with that, or you almost hurt somebody. And those were all real live things that came, and I've spent decades learning about you need to have quite a bit of space between reaction and response, or whatever right. those two things are. Yeah. And I haven't mastered it. And if you have something to say about that, I would love to hear it.
So I'm going to ask you a blunt question. No blame, just inquiry. You know better. Why do you keep doing it?
I guess I would say because it feels efficient and quick and timely, not necessarily
Right,
kind.
right,
I got
right.
that, but it feels very efficient, like, wow, I see it, I name
Yeah,
it, I
yeah.
blame it.
So I kind of want to pause right here. And you're my friend, Madison. We know each other. And I know you're diligent. I know you work on your mind. What I'm hearing is you're not yet really convinced about the better way. You're not really convinced yet. And I think for many of us, that's the key. And then, in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes, to some extent, they talk about the need to hit bottom. And I think there are different aspects of hitting bottom, but fundamentally, that's one way, hitting bottom. But there are other ways as well, without necessarily the huge catastrophe often involved in hitting bottom, where you become truly convinced. You let in conviction. And you help yourself to believe the better way. That's, I think, the real key a lot, to believe it. And not just to believe it, but to saturate yourself in the benefits of the better way so that your monkey mind, as it were, is really motivated to lean into the better way. And I think for a lot of people, it's like, are you really convinced? And can you help yourself develop to a deep conviction where you realize, like, once and for all, it's so much better for Madison. What a good person Madison is. She puts up with all these people. She's like a graphite rod in a nuclear reactor, absorbing all those stray neutrons, dealing with other people's chaos and all the rest of that. And what a good person Madison is. She doesn't need to go down that road anymore. That would be my suggestion, to challenge yourself to really, really believe what you know is true and to be kind to yourself about what's best for Madison. That's my two cents. What do you think?
I like it. I think the part that I don't do so often is the kindness toward the other people, which you're also saying would be the kindness toward me.
That's
Like
true too.
instead it's a feeling of this is an emergency and I've got the hose in my hand
Yeah.
and I keep spraying it. And yeah, and I'm hearing you because I have another chance to practice this tomorrow
Good.
afternoon. I don't have to wait very long to see whether I'm going to jump on people or not.
Yep. That's right. And finishing on this, as you're aware of, basically, when there's one red light flashing on the inner dashboard, that's where attention goes. So your attention's being hijacked. And this is another piece of it. Again, you want to help yourself believe in the better road. Okay. So, frankly, I'm going to be really blunt. I know you as well, to someone who's very determined, self-determined, and hates being controlled by other people. Right? You don't like being controlled. You don't like being a puppet. Well, Madam Madison, when that reaction grabs you, it's controlling you. You're letting it control you. You're giving it power. When your attention collapses around the hose or the mess or the words they use, chink, you are now a puppet. Gack. And that kind of feisty moxie you have, which I share, fuck that. Sorry, folks. I don't want to be controlled by that. And to reframe it, that reactivity, that little module in your brain, which is well intended, that little module is controlling you. No more. To take that stand. Okay. Good. Report back next week. See you then. All right. It's kind of a generosity to ourselves. It's a givingness to ourselves that we help ourselves walk the higher road, to stabilize in those motivations. Great. What do you think about helping yourself to develop conviction? You know, in Buddhism, there are these lists of strengths, like these five spiritual strengths. One of them is conviction. It's sometimes translated as faith because of some of the connotations of faith. I kind of prefer conviction, but it also means confidence that, you know, like Madison's example, that if you just chill and you let the reactivity of other people swirl on past and you stay stably present in your own noble intentions, your own good intentions, your wholesome intentions, things will work out for the best. Best odd strategy. That's confidence. So another thing here, in our politics today, and not just politics, but doing what we can to make a better world. It's so easy. I have friends who, when I'm with them, they have a really hard time not helplessly complaining about the state of the world and kind of doom scrolling. They're really caught by that. That's where their attention is going. That pony wants that kind of corn. Do, 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 do. Okay, what are the results? You know, so much about the Buddhist teachings about result, about everything, is really about cause and effect, you know, intention and result. You know, action, result. And so when we engage that action of being caught up in our fury, our helpless anger at them, past, you know, the 90 seconds or 9 seconds that it might be worth, really, you know, once we get past that, we can then turn back to our true intent, which is to send a little money to some judicial election somewhere in a state to support an organization, maybe like the Global Compassion Coalition, which is trying to, you know, really, really get at the deep causes of the crises that we're involved with today. You know, maybe it's to just know how you're going to vote. And that's all you can do. And you move on to what's for dinner. You know, that's a beneficial horse that you can ride. And I find it's really helpful often to just kind of clarify, okay, what's my beneficial intent here? Uncle Bob is wanting me to convince me about, I don't know what. So, but I don't want to involve myself in that argument. I have good intent. I don't, you know, one of my ponies wants to fight with Bob, but that's not a pony I want to ride today. All right. So identifying your own intent is really central. In Buddhism, you know, in the Eightfold Path, wise intent is one of the Eightfold factors, right, or wise intention. And it's interesting that two of the three have to do with mainly interpersonal relationships, you know, the intention of non-harming and the intention of ill will, which could be extended to our relationship with ourselves. The other one, the third, is the intention to be not stuck to or driven around avoiding pain or approaching pleasure. Relatively free in relationship to sensual desire and sensual pleasure. So the releasing of ill will, the releasing of the intent to harm, there are ponies within us that are cruel, and callous, and malicious. Okay, they have good intent way down deep, but we don't need to ride them. Great, Anne asked us a question. When we're triggered, how can we know if it's a trauma response when we react, or is it rooted in the reality of the other person's behavior? Great question. One is, over time, you start to recognize the turbocharging from previous experiences. You feel it in your body. You feel the amplification. Second, your mind can probably observe, especially in retrospect, if their reaction was out of proportion, really, to what actually happened. And to think about out of proportion, sometimes it helps. How would someone not named you, who's a reasonable, wise person, view what happened there? Would they think that your reaction was out of proportion to what the other person did? And the other, you know, that wise hypothetical or actual friend or teacher ally might say to you, no, they really did a bad thing there. You know, right on. So to me, those are some of the ways to help us ourselves. And I appreciate what you said there, Leslie, about that. So Linda asked a question. This goes also to another question comment that came earlier about dealing with narcissistic people, self-centered, or people who are using you as a means to their ends. They just want to rile you up, or they just want to spew and perform with a captive audience. Not good. So how do we get past the 9 seconds when we're being spewed at or caught up in their complaint? You know, I think lately a fair amount about this line from a poem by Miller Williams. You may know it. The line is essentially, "We do not know what secret wars are going on down there where the spirit meets the bone." Where the spirit meets the bone. And I try to just sort of, I don't want to be mistreated. I don't want to be threatened. You know, I'm very alert to actual threat. People can get weird. But on the other hand, if this is a person who is just really rattled and fired up and they've got their agenda, you know, I let it go for a little bit. You know, I have certain privileges through advantage that position me to be relatively able to do that. I'm male, I'm tall, you know, I'm vigorous, I'm healthy, I have a PhD. You know, I recognize not everybody has those that aid disability to stay in place. That said, however you can, you know, for me, it's helpful. And also internally, maybe there's a little mantra, I'm not implicated, I'm not implicated, not my problem, not my monkey, not my zoo, not my job, et cetera. You know, that can be really helpful for people too. And then at a certain point, you just go, I got it. What would you like me to do about this? Or what would make this right? Or I don't quite follow the purpose here. Is your purpose just to kind of release and have me, you know, receive it somehow? I can't do anything about what you're complaining about. Maybe you should talk to the person who can. You know, just find a place, try to keep the snark out, because that would be inflammatory. You know, maintain your dignity. Maybe physically take a step back, maybe start looking away, maybe look at your watch, you know, turn your body to the side. Just, you don't have to take it on board. You know, it's not yours. All right. I really want to pound the point with Madison and everybody. Help yourself to believe and to feel what you know is true. And including the feeling of the knowing of what's in your true best interest, which includes compassion and kindness toward other people, while setting appropriate boundaries and asserting yourself as needed, resting in that. And in all that, it's really interesting. Feel, if you can, my suggestion to you, the goodness of your generosity. You know, you have good intent. You're here to help. You're here to build up, not tear down. You're here to construct, not destruct. You're here to learn. You're investing your Wednesday evenings in this process. You know, appreciate yourself. As the Buddha put it, this will be my closing offering, find gladness in your goodness.